This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One thing that Republicans and Democrats can agree on is that this contested election has left many of us wanting to know more about election law and voting history. My guest, Alexander Kasar, is the author of The Right to Vote, The Contested History of Democracy in the United States. His book is really about how long it took most Americans to get the right to vote, and the various roles the courts and the legislatures had in upholding and eliminating restrictions. Kasar is a professor of history and public policy at Duke University. The Republicans have gone to the U.S. Supreme Court to challenge the Florida Supreme Court, while the Democrats are in the Florida courts making their case for counting the ballots that were never counted by hand. Many people are confused about why the challenges surrounding this presidential election are mostly being fought in state courts. I asked Kasar why most election law is state law. He told me this was a result of a political compromise.
When the Founding Fathers met in Philadelphia to write the Constitution, they debated having a national right to vote, national regulations on the right to vote, which would also have implied national control over certain kinds of procedures. And they decided not to do it. And they decided not to do it in part because they disagreed among themselves about figuring out a common standard. Very few of them, indeed, were Democrats in the sense that we understand it today. Most believed in a property requirement or tax-paying requirement of one sort or another. But even within that range, there was a lot of disagreement. And what they concluded was that any single national standard that they adopted would be unpopular in some states of the United States and thus might jeopardize ratification of the federal constitution. So the decision to decentralize control over the right to vote and voting procedures was a very pragmatic political decision made in the late 18th century to try to facilitate ratification of the constitution. And that's really the origin of a great deal that has followed from this since in the last 200 years.
We're watching this election get played out in the Florida courts, in the U.S. Supreme Court. Historically, where do the courts play the biggest part in interpreting election law?
Well, the court's role really historically has been, it's been an interesting evolution because in the 19th century, certainly the federal courts and the federal government as a whole kept pretty much hands off the voting system. This was a matter of state law, state control. State courts did adjudicate a number of battles within each state, interpreting different statutes, trying to figure out exactly what it meant. You know, exactly if there was a restriction that you had to be white to vote, the courts had to decide what the definition of white was, or in a number of states, for example, in the 19th century that excluded paupers from voting, it was left to the state courts to decide what the definition of a pauper was. So that the state courts have been involved. The federal courts and the federal government really took a pretty hands-off posture. The first major federal interventions into questions of the right to vote come up, of course, in the aftermath of the Civil War, when the 14th Amendment deals with the right to vote in part, and the 15th Amendment does well. But the 15th Amendment, and I think there's some confusion out there, I've heard this in discussions, the 15th Amendment does not say that African Americans have the right to vote. It says that states cannot discriminate based on race, color, or previous condition of servitude. So it is the federal government intervening, but still within a context or a framework of state law. Then, in fact, what happens in the late 19th and early 20th century is that the federal courts turn a blind eye to ways in which the states clearly were ignoring the intent of the 15th Amendment. The federal courts did not rule that various laws passed in southern states violated the 15th Amendment, even though it was clear that their intent, if it wasn't the letter of the law, with the disfranchised blacks.
You mean like literacy tests?
Literacy tests, poll taxes, cumulative poll taxes, understanding clauses, you know, which meant that you had to come in and you were given a passage of a state constitution to read, and you were supposed to indicate your understanding of it to the satisfaction of a white registrar, which would, in most cases, was nearly impossible. Now, and the federal courts, and there were cases, said, okay, well, this does not on its face violate the 15th Amendment, so it's fine, which was how we ended up with, 70, 80 years of 90% disfranchisement of the black population of the South with the sanction of the federal courts.
Since the federal courts had largely stayed out of election law and let that to the states, how did the federal courts end up becoming such an active part of election law during the civil rights movement in the 60s?
Well, I think that there was pressure on the courts that coexisted with pressure on Congress, and I think it came from several different directions. I mean, if one wants to look at the historical forces pushing this change, there was a significant grassroots movement of African Americans in the South that was pushing for change and demanding voting rights. This is also all happening, and I think this context is important, in the context of the Cold War and of an international propaganda campaign, one might call it, or certainly a battle of rhetoric about democracy in the Cold War era. And one thing that was increasingly clear to Congress and to the executive branch as well was that the fact that the United States did not fully enfranchise its population and had a disfranchised minority in the South that was black was a significant problem for us, for example, in talking to African nations or anywhere in the third world. So that there are a lot of pressures, domestic and international, that are coming to bear to do something to make the United States more fully democratic. Now, that said, the courts get involved in a two-pronged process. One is that Congress gets involved and passes legislation that is now federal legislation, the Voting Rights Act being the most important of 1965, then 1970, and violations of the Voting Rights Act will end up in federal courts. The Voting Rights Act of 1965 is also designed to elicit a federal court test of state poll taxes and state elections, which yields the decision that I referred to before, that wealth is not germane to voting. The other part of the process is that the court itself, the 60s court, the Warren Court, in legal terms, finds in the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, finds the grounds to judge and really disapprove of a large number of state laws that deal with the right to vote. I mean, the court finds in the Equal Protection Clause a principle, the notion that it is up to the federal government to really, protect the rights, the equal rights of all citizens, including in the area of voting. And that becomes a grounds for federal intervention in what had been a state matter.
My guest is historian Alexander Kasar, author of The Right to Vote. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Alexander Kasar. He's the author of the book, The Right to Vote, The Contested History of Democracy in the United States. He's also a professor of history and public policy at Duke University. Well, during this post-election period, we keep looking back to the Founding Fathers and the Constitution and wondering, what would the Founding Fathers have to say about the predicament we're in now? On the other hand, if we look back to that era, we'll see that in those days, the right to vote was a privilege. I mean, it wasn't really a right. It was a privilege that some people had and a lot of people didn't have. Who had the right to vote? Who didn't have the right to vote in the early days of the United States?
Well, certainly more people didn't have the right to vote than had the right to vote. The right to vote was possessed primarily by adult white male property owners, women did not have the right to vote, except in New Jersey, in a very interesting and revealing historical anomaly where women in New Jersey did have the right to vote for 20 years. Blacks in some northern states at the outset, and even free blacks in a few southern states, did have the right to vote, but most did not. And men who did not own property or pay taxes were excluded everywhere but Vermont at the outset.
When does the right to vote actually become a right?
I'm not sure that one can identify a moment, or I think one might want to break the question down further, sort of a right for whom. The talk of the right to vote becomes powerful in the course of the first half of the 19th century, and people are asserting a right to vote and saying that this is a right and not a privilege. And in the arguments that one sees, the formal arguments, the notion that voting is a privilege and not a right seems to be defeated by the middle of the 19th century. Yet there are asterisks attached to it. I mean, that it may be a right, but it's not a right, for example, that women possess. And in some states, it's still not a right that African Americans possess. So there's always been a kind of rhetorical slipperiness about that. And then in the late 19th century, there is a movement again away from the notion that voting is a right and turn back towards the notion that it's a privilege, although the language shifts again. They don't want to use the word privilege, except in the South they do restore the word privilege. And in fact, I think it's the Alabama State Constitution in the early 20th century rewrites its preamble to change the references to the right to vote to the privilege of voting. They actually change the wording there. Elsewhere, the language shifts so that they begin to talk of an earned right to vote. And for example, northern states in the late 19th century and the early 20th century implement literacy tests to vote, or English language literacy tests. There are surprising examples of that. New York State, in one dramatic case, imposes an English language literacy test in 1921, which remains on the books through the 1960s and disfranchises hundreds of thousands of people every year. And that's grounded in this notion that, well, voting is a right, but it's a circumscribed right and you have to earn it to some degree.
What were the rationalizations in the early history of the United States for allowing just property owners to vote?
The rationalizations were two. The rationales put forward were two. One was the notion that to vote you should have a, quotes, stake in society, that it made sense to limit the franchise to people who would be affected by public policies and who were going to stick around for a while. The second rationale was, I think, more powerful and more compelling to contemporaries, which was a notion that you had to be independent. And that word independence shows up all the time. And what it means is that you had to be, or people believed that you should be, free from certain kinds of economic pressures, free to make up your own mind, to reflect, to offer your own judgment. And the founding fathers, or people in the late 18th century, who saw a close link between economic condition and political condition, were convinced that someone who did not have economic independence would not have independence of judgment or political thought. Those are the basic rationales. Now, I think, you know, that said, I have to add, and I argue in the book, that the independence rationale is partly covering up another, which is that there is a fear of the property list. There is a fear that men who did not own property, who were poor, would, if they voted, act in such a way as to jeopardize the interests of property.
Let me read a quote from John Adams from 1776 that opens the first chapter of your book, The Right to Vote. He says, "The same reasoning which will induce you to admit all men who have no property to vote with those who have will prove that you ought to admit women and children. For generally speaking, women and children have as good judgments and as independent minds as those men who are wholly destitute of property. these last being, to all intents and purposes, as much dependent upon others who will please to feed, clothe, and employ them, as women are upon their husbands, or children on their parents. So he's basically comparing men without property to women and children, and that's a bad thing. Women and children, that's a bad thing.
That's right. Women and children are the sort of measuring stick, the litmus test of dependence and or lack of independence and lack of capacity to vote.
Where's that quote from, and where was he using this argument?
He was using it. I'm pretty sure that quote is from a letter that he wrote to James Wilson, who was a political figure from Pennsylvania. But Adams, in fact, says the same thing. It's interesting. One can find various articulations of that same position over about a 40-year period from Adams. He believed in it. And on the one hand, it is a statement of principle. On the other hand, it seems to me that what Adams is doing in that case, and Adams was really quite conservative on matters of voting rights, is that he is saying, look, this is a slippery slope. This is a Pandora's box. It goes back to what your question earlier about voting as a right. He's saying, if you open this up, you know, right now we just let propertied men vote, but if you open this up, if you start raising questions about whether the, you know, people who don't have property can vote, it's going to be endless. You know, then women are going to want the right to vote. People in all sorts of conditions, because once you start saying it's a right, then the question becomes, well, who should possess this right? And I think that in a sense, Adams was very perceptive. If you open it up, it's very hard to put the cap back on the bottle.
Did most of the founding fathers agree with Adams on this?
Yes, they did. There were several exceptions. Franklin was probably the most liberal exception. Franklin argued, even in the Constitutional Convention, that the franchise should go to all adult men. Jefferson was similarly liberal. It was interesting. He did believe that in order to exercise the franchise properly, you should own property, and particularly own land. But his solution to that was to give land to everybody, and then they could vote. But most of the founding fathers did not have such democratic views. They shared Adams' view.
So in the early days of the United States, how much did you need to own or to earn to qualify to vote?
It was more own than earn, and it varied state by state, and it depended in southern states it tended to be an acreage requirement. In the north, it tended to be a dollar value of your property. It's hard to translate it into current terms, but basically you had to be the equivalent of a middle-class property owner. You didn't have to be wealthy to vote, not by any means. And in some cases, really even owning something symbolic and small was adequate. But the basic standard was to be a middle-class property owner.
Say something happened and you lost what you owned. Could you no longer vote?
You could no longer vote. That is absolutely correct. If you lost your house, you could no longer vote. So the structures of certain mortgages, you could no longer vote. Or there is the celebrated anecdote that I quote in the book of Benjamin Franklin's story about a man losing his jackass, which counted as valuable property, and the jackass dying and his losing the right to vote as a consequence.
Right, and then Franklin says, so in whom resides the right to vote, in the man or in the jackass?
Exactly, which an extraordinary line on Franklin's part, which just cut right to the essence of the problem. And that line, you know, the man or the jackass, whom resides the right to vote, that line crops up. I've seen it in transcripts of state constitutional conventions 50 years later, where people are still saying the man or the jackass, and everybody knows what they're talking about.
You know, when we look back with such awe at the Constitution and the Founding Fathers, does this stuff give you pause? I mean, having studied as much as you have, the limitations on the right to vote and, you know, property rights and all that, how does it make you feel about using the thinking of that era as the litmus test for what we should be doing today?
Well, I think that's a very well-phrased question, because I think that one has to recognize that these people were living in a different era with different presumptions, a very different political culture, a very different social structure. And thus, when I get involved, for example, in discussions about the Electoral College, or when I hear discussions of the Electoral College today, in today's world, and people are defending the sanctity of the Electoral College and the Founding Fathers and their infinite wisdom created this, I have to say that I think that that's a very mistaken view. I mean, we are talking about people who created an Electoral College, for example, or created political institutions, who did not believe in democracy as we know it, who did not believe that most people should have the right. Many of them accepted slavery and endorsed slavery. This is a different world, and thus, to take their words or the institutions that they created as being sacrosanct and as being necessarily the guide for us to follow in the early 21st century strikes me as deeply mistaken.
Alexander Kaysar is the author of The Right to Vote, The Contested History of Democracy in the United States. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with historian Alexander Kaysar, author of The Right to Vote, The Contested History of Democracy in the United States. He's a professor at Duke University. In this contested election, Gore and Lieberman won the popular vote. If the Florida count is upheld in the courts, then Bush and Cheney will have won the electoral vote. If Gore wins in a recount, the Florida legislature is likely to challenge that by naming a slate of electors for Bush. I asked Kaysar about the history of the Electoral College.
Well, the Electoral College was created in part, again, out of compromise. They couldn't quite agree on how to elect the president. Some people thought that there should be direct election out in the countryside. Now, that wasn't to say by everybody, but by propertied adult white men. Others thought that Congress should elect the president. Still others thought that maybe state legislatures should elect the president. The Electoral College emerged out of a compromise, and again, one has to realize that, you know, deeply intelligent and thoughtful as the Founding Fathers were, you know, this was a group of men meeting sort of in a hot, sticky summer in Philadelphia in the middle of some time pressures around writing a constitution. They wanted to get this thing done. The compromise they reached of the Electoral College, you know, for one thing, as a number of people have recently pointed out, because it was linked to representation in Congress, also was a way of weighting the political power of the southern states with a percentage, 3/5 of the number of slaves. But it was also created to create a kind of buffer between the people and the selection of the executive. The basic notion of the Electoral College, the basic conception of it, was that people would become members of the Electoral College who were independent-minded, thoughtful, responsible, and knowledgeable citizens who would exercise their own judgment in selecting an executive. One requirement, for example, to be a member of the Electoral College was that you could not hold office. This is an era when there are no political parties, when they're creating the Electoral College, and there was a notion that it would be another group of wise men who would probably listen to the views of people in their state, but who would act independently. It's a conception completely different than what we have now.
Well, you know, the image, I guess, originally was that these would be wise people who we could trust to deliberate on our behalf, whereas now no one seems to know who the electors really are, how they're chosen.
They seem to be chosen for party loyalty, and, you know, I, like you, in recent weeks have seen some occasional television interviews with people who are electors. They're flattered to be electors, and they say that it would never occur to them in the world to do anything other than to cast their ballot for the person that they are already pledged to. They do not see themselves as being engaged in a deliberative process.
Now, the electors are chosen according to representation in Congress, so that you get one elector per member of the House and one elector per senator. So it's partially proportional, but every state, no matter how large or how small, gets those two votes, one for each senator. How was that formula originally created?
It was created as one of a series of compromises that occurred at the Constitutional Convention between the big states and the small states. The senatorial add-on, adding the two electoral votes for the number of senators from each state, which is two, was a concession to the small states. And I mean, that's why it was done. Now, one thing we have to realize is that the difference in size between big states and small states in 1790 or 1800 was not nearly as great as it is today. The smallest states still have three electoral votes, but the largest states have far more than the largest states did at the time. And certainly in the recent election, in the election of this year, the small state skew, as it's called, the small state advantage, is in fact what seems to have tipped the election to Governor Bush, if indeed Governor Bush is going to become the president. I mean, the reason that he was able to win the Electoral College without winning the popular vote is because of these senatorial add-ons. Governor Bush won, I think the figure is 19 of the 26 states that have less than 10 electoral votes. He won 12 small states that have a population equal to California's, and for those 12 states, he won 73 electoral votes compared to 54 that Gore won for winning California. That difference alone in an election this close was enough to tilt the outcome.
Explain a little bit more why you think that each state having one electoral vote per senator, so every state, large and small, gets those two votes, you know, one per senator. Explain a little bit more why you think that that makes things unbalanced instead of more fair.
Sure. I think it makes things unbalanced in terms of, I think, our own conceptions of democracy, which is that each person's vote should carry equal weight. For example, in the smallest states, which have only one delegate to the House of Representatives, one representative in Congress, they get one electoral vote for that, and then you add on two senators, which is to say you're adding another 200% to their electoral vote. In New York, which has 31 representatives in Congress, you're adding another two, which is only a small increment. The upshot of this is that if one looks at the number of electoral votes per capita in each state, the range is enormous. I think these numbers are fairly close, that in North and South Dakota, there is an electoral vote in the Electoral College for every roughly 220 or 230,000 people. In New York, in comparison, it's for about 570,000 people.
Do you think the electoral system should be phased out or reformed?
I think there are potentially some ways to reform it, for example, by eliminating the senatorial add-on. My own preference would probably be to figure out some way to phase it out, although I think that the political obstacles to doing that from the small states will be considerable.
My guest is Alexander Kasar. He's a historian and the author of the new book, The Right to Vote. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Alexander Kasar, author of the book, The Right to Vote, The Contested History of Democracy in the United States. He's also a professor of history and public policy at Duke University. Your book is about the history of the right to vote. Do you think of the United States as having universal suffrage now?
I think of the United States as having something close to universal suffrage now. I think of the United States as having gained universal suffrage only roughly in 1970, which is very late in the game, and that runs counter to most of our images. There are two major groups in our society now that are not enfranchised. One are people who have been convicted of crimes, roughly 4 million people, according to the best statistics we have, which are not very precise. And the other are resident non-citizens, of the United States, including permanent residents. And it's a different kind of argument, different kind of issue. But I think of us as having something close to universal suffrage now, but that it's recent. I think that we have an anti-democratic tradition in the United States that shows up throughout this history and that is still fairly strong, and that we also have the rather peculiar fact that we have extremely low electoral turnout, which is we may have universal suffrage, but that may not be the same thing as having a vibrant democracy when only 50% of the people are voting, even in a close election.
Just looking at how the post-election is playing out in the courts and possibly in the Florida legislature, what outcome do you think would be best in terms of precedent for the future of voting and democracy in America?
That's a good question. In principle, I think that the outcome would be best that focuses on the rights of voters to vote, because those are the people who really do have rights. I mean, neither Al Gore nor George Bush has a right to be president. Voters do have the right to vote and have their votes counted. I suspect that, or my own intuition would be that a hand recount of probably all of Florida's ballots would be the best in terms of precedent. That it would establish that the error rates of machines are not going to be tolerated, and that the way to deal with a very close, whisker-thin election is to focus on counting the ballots rather than necessarily on legal maneuvering to see who wins the last technical legal battle.
What do you think the worst-case scenarios would be in terms of the precedent that would be set?
I think, in general, the worst-case scenarios are those where the precedent is set that you can get away with naked partisan intervention. I think that, for example, if the Florida legislature were to intervene and were to select the electors after, say, some partial recounting process began to suggest that Vice President Gore might be ahead, I think, and if the Florida legislature got away with that, I think that that would be very negative as a matter of precedent. I think that if it went to the House of Representatives and the House of Representatives got involved in a very partisan way, that would also be a negative precedent. On the other hand, I think that there's something to be said in terms of our political culture and our knowledge of how things really work about this process that has been going on, which in some respects is negative. But we are all seeing that institutions and processes which we have often wanted to think of as being neutral and fair-minded, that there really are strong partisan elements in them, and that these institutions are controlled by political parties, and that the political parties act in self-interested ways. I'm not sure that that's a bad thing for us to learn about the way in which our own system works.
And do you think that it's inevitable that a political system work in partisan ways like that?
I think it's inevitable that there will be strong pressures for it to do so. I think that part of what we as citizens or part of what we try to create institutions to do is to limit the extent to which the parties can just control that or control it, say, just in their own interest. I mean, for example, we have a two-party system, and the rules of elections and election machinery in most states makes it quite difficult for third parties to make much headway. Now, I think that it's inevitable that parties are going to play a role in this machinery. They're the people who care most. They're the people whose livelihoods depend on it. But I think that our current system is too heavily reliant on the parties, and that the creation of different rules and different institutions that will make it fairer for everybody is certainly possible.
Alexander Kasar is the author of The Right to Vote. He's a professor of history and public policy at Duke University.